I welcome the opportunity to speak with you about J.B. by Archibald MacLeish, primarily because I have found in the last 10 years since I've been at that university, I haven't really been able to teach the text that I know and love very deeply. And so it's been one of my special pleasures here to go to texts which have stayed in the American consciousness, and in some cases even within the Christian community, like Archibald MacLeish's J.B., and it's a special privilege to return to these texts. And I do it on the basis of a rather interesting set of distinctions that Nathan Scott has introduced when he talks about the American and American in our culture. He says, really, we ought to distinguish between what's recent, what's contemporary, and what's modern. And he uses a very careful set of distinctions that way, namely a chronological one. He says the recent is that which has been available within the last 10 years, roughly. And it's difficult to teach what is recent, because what happens is you find that so much that is so terribly interesting and recent slips rapidly into the past and into a kind of a dustbin. So we reach back to what we call contemporary literature, and you really, or often you will find in many universities now, recent literature courses, and you'll find contemporary literature courses. And for Nathan Scott, the contemporary is anything of about a 25-year span. And then he says, of course, we must keep in mind, however, that when we speak of our age, we speak of it as the modern. And for him, and I suppose for most professors at least, the modern reaches back from the very recent, all the way back to the period of the Enlightenment, the post-Renaissance period. So that I suppose anyone here who has read or been reared in high school or in a conventional college program is familiar with the modern as anything that has burst forth into our consciousness since the time of the Renaissance, or especially since the time of the Enlightenment in the early 18th century. Now, my fascination with J.B. partly arises out of the fact that I've seen it performed by church groups, and I've always had some skepticism about that and wondered why it was performed by church groups. The fact is that it's a play which most of you know is a part not of a recent but of a contemporary period. It comes out of the late 50s. It's a post-Korean kind of play. It comes at the end of the decade of McCarthy and Eisenhower. It comes in at a time of great national disquietude, the so-called Quiet 50s. And it came at a time when there was a kind of, we were in what is called a great religious revival. And I remember that I was at a particular university where we got Martin Marty to come and speak. It was at a Southern university. And Martin Marty came to speak at a religious emphasis week. And the first day, there were thousands of students at the convocation. And what Martin Marty did, and this was at the same time that J.B. was being performed at Yale, and ran up and down the East Coast, and then was bought out in the form in which we know it now. And he started out the second day with a series of sick jokes about the Christian faith and with a critique of the Billy Graham crusades that were going on at that time. And the audience dropped by half. By the fourth day, he managed to alienate just about everyone in the audience except for an extremely loyal following of about 250 students out of a university of around 14,000 at the time. But he was sympathetic to J.B., and as associate editor of the Christian Century, one of the fascinating things was to see the reaction to this play at the end of the 50s. It just so happened that it was first performed along the New England coastline at Yale University, and ran a few times and came down and was performed. Men like John Sciardi had seen it up at Yale, wrote about it in Saturday Review with the highest acclaim. Then he would write a few months later another column in Saturday Review called J.B. Revisited, in which he would take back just about everything that he had said kindly about the play. But where it really got into the national scene was largely through a kind of happy circumstance. There was at Union Theological Seminary and Columbia University at that time a young and very gifted drama critic named Tom Driver. And Tom Driver was told by a friend of his, namely the president of Union Theological Seminary at that time, Henry Van Dusen, that Archibald MacLeish, who was known primarily as a secular poet, somewhat critical of the tradition, had written a play after he had written some early radio plays, would seem to be extremely moving and gripping a play based on the Book of Job. And so all three of these distinguished gentlemen from Union Theological Seminary went to see J.B. There was Samuel Terrien, the man who wrote the Job commentary in the Interpreter's Bible, probably one of the finest commentaries available on the Book of Job. He has also published a number of independent books on the Book of Job. And so he is a specialist of the highest order on the poetry of Job and the theology of the Book of Job. Henry Van Dusen, the president of the seminary, went with him, and Tom Driver also. And all three went away from the play with mixed, differing, and even opposed judgments about the play. The most sympathetic of the responses came from Samuel Terrien, the exegete, who I think we must assume knew more about the Book of Job than the two other responders. But Van Dusen was enamored of it as a really serious attempt on the part of the modern playwright to deal with the contemporary audience. And Tom Driver said, great theater, mediocre drama, and probably the lousiest theology that he had seen on the stage in a long, long time. Well, that response was so intense that finally Marty Marty and his friends at Christian Century asked Mr. MacLeish to please write for the Christian Century a series of responses to the kinds of probing that were taking place all over the country. And this is how I'm just trying to refresh some of our memories and some younger memories about how this particular play swept the American consciousness at the end of the 50s. Paul Tillich was writing a particular article in one of the larger Slick magazines. Reinhold Niebuhr did the same thing in Life magazine, if I remember correctly. Everywhere you went, Rabbi Samuel Finkelstein, a great Jewish critic at Hebrew Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio, if I remember correctly, did a marvelous study of play. And what happened at the same time is that two books in the Bible came into prominence in literature courses on the undergraduate level. The wisdom literature, what we call the wisdom literature of the shamans, began to be taught in world literature courses with a new kind of enthusiasm. A case book on the Book of Job came out and included MacLeish's play called The Voice Out of the Whirlwind. And another book came out on Ecclesiastes to accompany it, because there was a kind of cynicism that was surfacing. It would anticipate everything that would take place in the 60s, partially, but was to be anticipated by this particular play. So it's sort of pleasant to come back to it after roughly two decades to realize it's one that probably has a kind of perdurability in the American consciousness. I have a feeling that in the anthologies, and some of them I have seen, Archibald MacLeish's J.B., will come through. I remember that for all his criticism of it, John Chardy said, what is significant about J.B. is that since Maxwell Anderson's time, it was the first really successful attempt to bring to the stage a poetic and metrical sound that had not been successful. And I think all those of us who know Maxwell Anderson, probably through the Robert Burton play we saw Queen Anne of a Thousand Days before we came to Holden Village. It was on the educational TV and made the whole national scene several weeks ago. We owe that to Maxwell Anderson's script for it originally. But beyond that, there haven't been very many successful verse plays. And here was one of the finest. Now, as we, how many of you have read the play somewhere along the line? How many of you have seen the play? How many of you have been in the play? Or heard the play? It would be another very satisfying. Have you been in the play also? Yeah. What role did you play?
Take that back. I think I worked, backstage on a lot of it, but heard it and, was assistant director. And
now, see, I have to reveal a bias I have as a teacher. Although I think teachers can only teach about literature, the beautiful thing about being a teacher of literature is that you must begin with something concrete, like a text. And the neat thing about that is it always keeps you very, very close to the experience that the reader has. And I'd like to presume or assume that you've had some experience either with the text or with the play in a particular way. But because I couldn't be sure of that, I thought maybe it would be good to rehearse what happens in JB. And to do this, I put on the board a kind of sketch of the scenes. Now, before you look at that, though, let's try to fill in the staging. To get you some sense of why people thought this was such a tremendously religious play and part of the renaissance of religious interest at the end of the 50s. Does anyone remember where the play takes place? What the setting of the play is? Now, I'm not talking about the general cultural setting that we've already talked about, but something that's frequently slipped by if you look at the text too quickly. Anyone remember where? Go ahead. It takes place in a circus tent. A kind of image for McLeish of the whole pattern of life of the world. Let me read to you the first description he gives of this, because you'll sense the whole way in which the staging and the scene tries to pull us into the setting. The scene throughout is a corner inside an enormous circus tent where a sideshow of some kind has been set up. There is a rough stage across the corner, on the left of which a wooden platform has been built at a height of 6 or 7 feet. Now I'm going to insult your intelligence by I'm going to pause before some of these things. Because McLeish, though most of you know this, is making use of a very ancient tradition. First of all, he's going to use that circus tent as the sort of metaphor for the world that takes place in the play. Those of you who've read the play will know that when we hit about scene six, and you have Ruth in the atomic blast, what happens to the circus tent? It just absolutely blows off. And much of the action that moves up to that point is within the tent. When the atomic blast takes place, the tent top is removed from the stage. And where are we placed? As we would have been placed in classical Greek theater, under the open vault of the heavens. You know, it's a little thing in the staging, but it's extremely important thing to keep in mind, because it suggests the universal kind of assertion that McLeish was trying to make about modern man's predicament in the modern world, particularly with the question of what concerned the Holden Village last week and is still present in the biblical studies this week, the question of human suffering and its relationship to our need for justice. Okay? Now, notice how he described that setting on the stage. There's a little platform. It is stage left. Why is that important? Anyone know or remember from their seeing, hearing, or reading of a play? I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand. I'm assuming that this kind of little detail may slip from mine. Because he goes on. To the right is a deal table with 7 straight chairs. There is a door-shaped opening in the canvas to the right rear. Above, a huge slanted pole thrust the canvas out and up to make the peak of the corner. Now, frankly, I've seen the play staged about 3 or 4 times. Usually when you saw it staged, the circus idea was present, but it usually was present within the what we would call the main body of the theater. And you maybe have had a jut stage, and usually you had Zeus and Nichols come down the aisles selling their balloons and their popcorn. And they would pull the audience into the circus atmosphere. Now, the other thing about this is interesting is that there is a stage left where Nichols will always do his speaking. It is the place for Satan. There is also a stage right. It's where Zeus will wear the god mask. So that what we have here, and this is how it was often staged, is a tent, a universe outside that tent, two figures from the circus, broken down actors, Zeus and Nichols, who wear two different masks throughout the play, and the masks are the masks of God and Satan. Stage left, stage right. God always higher than Satan. And the dialogue and the argument that takes place about them is hovering over the human action that takes place in the center of the stage. Now remember how carefully close that is to the book of Job. For how does Job open? It has a prologue and it has an epilogue. Well, if you've ever read any ancient literature from the ancient Near Eastern world, including the book of Job, you know that when the gods get together in the heavens for counsel, and when there is a kind of debate, watch out for man, because there may be difficulties on the human stage. In the Near Eastern world, if you are familiar with, say, such ancient epics as the Epic of Gilgamesh, or the how many of you have at least heard about the Odyssey? If you've ever just even looked into the Odyssey, you know that it begins with a council among the gods, particularly about human beings and their understanding of whether the world they live in is just or unjust. Hence, we have in J.B. MacLeish's use of a very ancient problem, what we call a theodicy, the question of whether the universe in which we live is a well-ordered, just, harmonious universe, appropriate to man's expectations and his understandings. But notice what else is there, he says. Clothes that have the look of vestments of many churches and times have been left about at one side, and the other of the stage, and the light at the beginning, such light as there is provided by bulbs dangling from hanks of wire. The feel is of a public place at late night, the audience gone, no one about, but maybe a stagehand somewhere cleaning up, fooling with the lights. That setting, then, is the stripped down, confined, but universal setting for a rehearsal or a replay of the drama of Job in the 20th century via the particular MacLeish version of that scene. Now, before we go into judgment about it, let's look at the play. And what I've done is sketched the scene here, the scenes out, just with the rough outline. You have a prologue, and I think I should anticipate this very quickly. In the first prologue, there are Zeus, who will take the god mask on him, Nichols, who will take the Satan mask, and there's one other voice. And I think it's kind of important to keep it in mind because it usually slips away from us. Does anyone remember who it is. There's what is called the distant voice. Those of you who have text will recognize it. It only appears, for example, at the end of the entire prologue, page 24. The bulbs go out, darkness, silence, in the silence. Now again, I'm sort of insulting the intelligence of people who are familiar with the play, but I found that many students I've had and readers of the play overlook this additional character. A distant voice, whence comest thou? And Mr. Zuss says, that's my line. And Nichols says, I didn't speak it. And the audience, although it will not, it'll just have this little clue here. And it will only be given one or two clues of this type throughout the play, will hear a voice in the performance, which is obviously meant by McLeish to be what? The voice of God in the play. Okay? That voice will appear especially later on when Job is led to his repentance. But that voice and its meaning in the play will lead us to a great deal of, I think, conflict about what Mr. McLeish is about in this rendition of the book of Job for a modern audience. Well, what they do, of course, is they argue. And those of you who are familiar with the book of Job may be familiar with what seem to be the main arguments of the opening prologue. Does anyone remember these from your reading or hearing about the book of Job? What's the main argument that Satan has as he, I know Norman Nagel, who is occasionally here, has a very famous sermon about wandering to and fro. And what he suggests is that whenever you run across anyone who is just simply wandering to and fro, watch out. There's trouble ahead, because this is the way Satan is described in the opening prologue of the book of Job. The mind is at preparing for mischief, obviously. He's wandering to and fro, and what possible question comes to Satan in the prologue to the book of Job? Does anyone remember? Yes, ma'am.
Doesn't he intimate that God did not lavish his gifts on everyone?
All right. There's there are really a number of questions, but that seems to be one of the largest questions that the book of Job raises. It's that it continues in Western, even Christian tradition as a fundamental question is apparent if you look at the New Testament carefully at times. Remember when the rich young man came to Jesus and wanted to know whether he was worthy of the kingdom of God, and Jesus replied to him, what's in the law? And he says, I've kept everything from my youth up. And then what does Jesus say to him? Remember that strange statement? Sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and come and follow me. And I suppose the real interest for a contemporary reader isn't so much only Jesus' response. You know, we hear that he was deeply moved because he loved the young man. But what's even more fascinating is the response of the disciples to the whole predicament. Remember what they say to Jesus right after that? Who can be saved? Hey, look, here was a rich young man who from all human, and this is good Old Testament prior certainly to the book of Job theology, that if what's a sure sign that God is on your side? The fact that you have riches. So when Satan raises that question in the prologue, he's probing at the very basic theological issues of the relationship between prosperity and blessedness. And his presumption is that Job is a faithful Job primarily because he has been blessed. What's the other question that's linked to that then? It gives us the problem, some of the problem of the book of Job.
Well, problem of suffering, stated very simply by Nichols on page 11, where he says, if God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God.
All right. Now, you're already leaping into McLeish's interpretation of this. If God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God. Take the even, take the odd. I would not live here if I could. Is that right? Or would not be here if I would?
Would not sleep here.
Would not sleep here. It changes from poetry to poetry, except for what two things?
Except for the little green leaves and the wind on the water.
Okay. Except for the little green leaves and the wind on the water. It's McLeish's way of putting before us specific problems. If God is good, then obviously he doesn't have power. If God has power, obviously he's terribly arbitrary and from a human perspective is not good. Now notice what McLeish gives as his answer very early. What makes it possible for men to survive in this kind of world then? The sort of a kind of aesthetic relationship, after all, I guess in the state of Washington, from what I hear, must be a very lovely place. And if you've got your druthers, you can find them in viewing the falls at Holden Lake or meditating on the infinite variety of splashing water. It's all there, the green leaf and the wind of the water. Now, another reason I was fascinated by this play is because one of the most interesting books I'd read before I came to Holden was Jakob Bronowski's The Ascent of Man. And those of you who may have been familiar with the television series are maybe familiar with Bronowski's very beautiful, rational, virtuous, some would say paganism, some would say humanism, that dominates the book. It's the kind of thing I think we're going to feel at work in McLeish. And it's the kind of thing we want to, I think, respond to out of our particular perspective. See what is the kind of strategy and whether this is an appropriate kind of thing that should be performed in Christian churches or Jewish churches for that matter. Whether we can give it an affirmative response or whether we get it a discriminating response or whether we are polemically antagonistic about what McLeish has done to our tradition. These are the ways, I think, in which, or some of the ways in which we can respond to the work. There's one other problem in the book of Job. Some of you may remember. The fact is that what about Job? It's the question is, really, will he love God for naught, as Nichols quotes it, for nothing? Now, what other problem do we have about Job? What privileged knowledge do we have in terms of the relationship between God and Satan over Job? What kind of a man is he? This complicates it for our later reading of the play. What problem does Job have in the probing of his sufferings that makes it so difficult to come up with a very happy and simple answer to the book of Job, at least as the prologue sets it up for us?
Because he's righteous.
Ah, he is a man of integrity and upright. What can he not do? He cannot, fudge on his integrity, and on his integrity particularly. This man, if there's false guilt that he asserts to or gives into, he in a sense has really let go of what is one of the great problems of the book and suggests some of the questions that are always raised about the relationship of the prologue and the epilogue to the work. Most of us who work with the book of Job are probably spared the mighty struggle that takes place in the inner part of the book of Job. We know it primarily through the prologue and through the epilogue, and we know the words from it primarily. What the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord, which is one of our favorite funeral texts. Or we know it through our favorite Easter text. I know that in this flesh I will see God, and that my vindicator will stand. And, of course, that's a marvelous Easter passage. I was always gratified to see that in the most recent commentaries, That passage is simply taken to mean exactly what it says, that Job is brought to the extremities of human limits when he recognizes that he is going to die. And he has this imaginative vision that he will have a redeemer, a vindicator, who will plead the cause that he has as the arguer, who in the face of his suffering is a man upright, of integrity, and righteousness. All right. So in that first little prologue, we get the setting. As Andy suggested, the argument between Zeus and Nichols. What will happen to Job if he is genuinely tested? Does he really love God for nothing? Well, in order to reinforce how beautiful his life is, we get the second scene. Scene one, Thanksgiving Day. And there's probably no finer picture of what we would call a prosperous, upper New England, middle class family on Thanksgiving Day with good American civil religion, as you have in scene one of Archibald MacLeish's J.B. They are all there, the prosperous man with his lovely, beautiful, slightly legalistic wife, who is certain that nothing in this world, or as Ann Landers says it in our area of the country, there are no free lunches, and is absolutely positive that there are no free lunches with respect to God's grace. We always owe for what we get. And that's the one thing the kids have to learn on Thanksgiving Day, is to be thankful, and to be thankful with words. And of course, she, as we've seen this happen often with parents, with young people, she runs through the family, each one with the lesson of learning how to say thanks, because it is our duty. And one of the major conflicts, of course, between her and J.B. is J.B.'s arguing that it's always got to be gift and grace. It's unselfconscious, the thanksgiving that human beings feel for the goodness that they get. All right. Now, in order to move through this relatively rapidly, but to get some sense of the direction of the text, you should know that we then step back into the argument, and we know that, as John Ciardi would say when he revisited J.B., he said, at first I thought he was a young man of upright integrity, but he said, when I read it a second time and saw it a second time, I realized that he was just a fatuous American businessman. And that's a rather severe judgment on him, but as you know, and I don't know if you've had the kind of experience, but you are going to know the kinds of people who've had the experiences in contemporary American culture. What happens is J.B. goes through a series of absurd, inexplicable, irrational experiences of evil. And they come one on top of the other, in ways in which I'm sure if you have ever seen the play, you either anticipate this may happen to me or it has happened to someone I know. So what happens? And we know of stories of this type. First one, they are there with their family and they have these lovely children, David, Mary, Jonathan, Rebecca, and Ruth. The oldest son, apparently in the Korean War, one of these terrible absurdities we've all heard about in all wars. When does he die? After the war is over, apparently. Whom has he been killed by? Probably his own men. Remember, those of you who've seen The Deer Hunter, or if you've seen Tolstoy's War and Peace in the Russian version, or if you've seen any film about war, the sense of the total chaos that takes place. Whereas you see in that famous Russian picture of War and Peace, nobody knows who the enemy is for sure. And there they are killing and being killed, and this terrible plight takes place here with the announcement and the terrible recognition that their oldest son is dead. Now, most of us would say this is enough calamity for one life in the modern world. And I suppose the reason that McLeish made the play as periodic or episodic as he did is that our identification never becomes that intense with the characters, because if it would, we couldn't abide all the suffering that's present here. In other words, I always think of Neil Simon, you know, in whose comedies come so close to the tragic that we're always preserved from feeling how outrageous our experience can be. But here in J.B., there's a really genuine sense of calamity after calamity, but not so intense that we can't preserve from overwrought emotional response to it. Next thing that happens to Job, or J.B., and his wife Sarah. Anyone remember? Typical thing that we've all read about, have had happen in our congregations, many times in our relations, sometimes in our family. Four kids, teenagers, in a car, driving fast, one drunk, and they hit the abutment, like at a rail underpass. And two of their teenage children, who are riding in the car, not drivers, are eliminated. Another catastrophe. Only this one is particularly vicious, because McLeish, who was very sensitive about what was happening in American culture, and who had a kind of regulated hatred of the press, could not avoid writing into this scene one of the most stinging indictments of the American press that I know of. And he wrote it right after he had talked about that. He had written a marvelous essay when he was at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism to give a lecture on the nature of the problem of poetry in the press, is the title of it. It's a marvelous essay on how the American populace, through the mass media, has been so inured to emotional response to what's happening in the world that, you know, we can sit at the table and we can say, Mary and Jonathan, J.B.'s son and daughter, were killed in this tremendous accident last night. Pass the salt, will you, please? You know, there's just no sense of a dislocation into human life, precisely because our feelings, according to McLeish, have been so dulled and stunted by all the violence and by our continual exposure to the media. So that by the time we get to the Vietnam War or to Kennedy's in the 60s assassination, and we're seeing this right before our eyes, the intensity of the feeling and the distance from the import of these events may have gone even too far. One doesn't know. But what is terrible about this scene, if you recall, is the newspaper man, in order to get the picture of the terror in a mother's eyes when she hears that her children have been killed, is he uses a young woman as a decoy to tell it so that he can hide behind her, and then as a spectator from the outside for the public, get this particular picture of Sarah responding to the announcement of death. It's a very sickening kind of scene, but McLeish works with it deliberately.
Does he ever admit that the Pentagon was happy that it's that way, inured to the violence of war?
Well, it's like Ernest Becker's denial of death. You know, if we had to face the fact that we are going to die every minute of our waking life, we would probably be paralyzed into inaction. McLeish feels very, very strongly about that. And there is a kind of common sense. I mean, there's about as much pain as any human being can take, and we simply click out of it, or we go into shock of one sort or another. Now, whether this is, you know, you want to elaborate on your observation a little bit?
Oh, I know that I worked a little with a newspaper photographer in Chicago, and I know they don't do that, especially the Chicago American would do it, push around. But I think it goes beyond. Of course, they'll say that's what the people want.
Well, depends. I know their ethics. Probably some of the most vicious pictures you've ever seen in the paper are pictures which show people in moments of catastrophe. And the first humane question you have is, hey, look, instead of taking that picture, why weren't you helping? And I think most photographers that I know would say, obviously, the first human response is to help the person in need. But there are other photographers, and there have been famous movies made on the notion that that's exactly what they're out for, is that picture, that the capturing of that particular moment.
Front page of the photographer.
Yes. Or Ace in the Hole, remember that with Kirk Douglas? Very famous one. Rebecca is the next one. We have a whole series. We want to just summarize very quickly. Does anyone remember what happens to Rebecca? Yes, a young daughter. Raped and killed in a lumber yard by a 19-year-old mentally disturbed young boy. I don't know how you are in the Northwest, but we read about this in the Midwest on occasion.
Ted Bundy is from Tacoma.
All right, and I know I've heard stories about what's happened out in this area. You have this sort of thing. It happens to JB. And then finally, now these are all personal, but now you get the cosmic dimension. In scene six, their last remaining daughter, Ruth, is apparently killed by an atomic blast, which destroys all of JB's possessions. He is a sort of large bank owner. He's a prosperous man. And McLeish uses the brilliant device of working with the atomic source on JB's skin as the disease that plagued Joe. Remember, he had to scrape him with the potsherds. So the atomic sores are there. He's in rags. And as I mentioned before, the tent top is taken off. He is left naked and alone, where we would expect that he would have been bought to the urging that had been bought to him by his wife earlier. What should you do in that predicament? Curse God and die. What intensifies this even worse is that who leaves him at that point? Sarah does. His wife leaves him. He is left alone under the sky, atomic sores. Everything has been taken from him. Now, this is built up very carefully by Zuss and Nichols, who claim, of course, that you really do not suffer until when? We saw one of the black cats in the village this morning brilliantly chase a little chipmunk, and it ran about a block, and the chipmunk just could not escape. The cat pounced, got it, bought the little chipmunk still wriggling and crying up past the chalet. And of course the observation is, the pleasant general observation, that this moment of death must come to all chipmunks where there are cats doing their instinctual business in our world. And the response from one of the young people there was, but that's not the case if you're the chipmunk who's crying as you're being held in the cat's mouth. You don't care about general laws that govern the universe when you are the statistic. And, of course, this is exactly the argument that Nichols brings to Zuss about the nature of JB's suffering. After all, even though every one of those things is a horrible and terrible thing, where has he not yet felt the suffering?
Himself.
Strike him in the withers. And that's where the sores come out. And when you are struck with the pain of your own suffering, then the question is, will you love God for nothing? Well, the chorus comments on this in scene 8. And brilliantly out of the past, along come the comforters. And these comforters are the biblical comforters: Zophar, Eliphaz, and Bildad. Now, I'm not going to assume that you've read the book of Job recently. There are actually, in the book of Job, how many comforters? Not three, but four. Elihu, E-L-I-H-U, one of the young comforters, is not included by McLeish in JB. Rabbi Finkelstein is pretty sure that the role of Elihu has been taken by McLeish as playwright. And that if we want to really find where Elihu comes in, it is only if we understand that McLeish is the playwright seeking to give comfort to modern man with his experience of unjustified suffering in the modern world. The comforters that occur here, or appear here, Zophar, Eliphaz, and Bildad, are really the old comforters, but they come with our contemporary reasons for explaining away the problem that is raised by, if God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God. So that you have, if I remember correctly, you have Zophar, who is the priest, and who is going to argue that what is there always and only for man in the universe? Blue depths of mystery. Religion. Eliphaz will argue as a psychoanalyst or a doctor in the modern world. Whatever guilt we feel for our plight in the universe is probably the dung under the fingernails, the mindless unconsciousness which has formed us all and over which we have and are not to be held responsible. Bildad is a Marxist, as some of you may know. How can you talk about individual suffering with any kind of weight when you know, frankly, that on the way in history where necessity rules, the question of individual suffering doesn't matter at all. The thing that really matters is whether the nation or the people in general will succeed. The interesting thing about Archibald MacLeish's JB is that JB refutes each one of the modern comforters. The blank depth of blue, the blind depth of the unconsciousness, and the lidless depth of history. He will not buy any of these for reasons that he gives in that particular scene. But he does repent before the voice of God, which comes out with the marvelous poetic passages from the book of Job. And here's where, unless you've read the book of Job, you find yourself confused when you come to the end of JB. Because as you read it, you discover that the poetry of the book of Job and the act of repentance that characterizes JB is frequently misconstrued by the reader in the same way that it's misconstrued by Zeus and Nichols. Zeus and Nichols do not understand the reason that JB repents before God's words to him at the end of Job. Each one thinks that he is going to gain a victory, and each one is disappointed in JB. For JB will reject both Zeus in his God mask and Nichols with his cynicism. And he will be left in a terrible plight until the last scene, in which it opens, does anyone remember, with a sprig of forsythia. His wife comes back to him, and the final concluding notion of the play. Namely, that what are we left with in a world in which if God exists, he is only a distant voice. He does not care. But if he only exists and does not care, what are we left with? Religion, in Zeus's sense, praise of God, even though we can't understand our world, or the cynicism of Nichols. And Nichols' cynicism is such that it runs through the whole play, and it is rejected by J.B. His main line is there anything worse than death? And what do you think J.B.'s response to that question is? Yes. What is it? Well, that's the modern plight that McLeish would probe as a sharp secular prophet in our time. Anything worse than death that you can think of? You know, the assumption being that in the West, and particularly in the Christian West, the answer would be that the worst thing is death, particularly what kind of death? Eternal death. But suppose that McLeish, through the character of Nichols and his cynicism, assumes that there is something worse than death, and it's what J.B. is facing. And behind this rests, for McLeish, some of the terrible experience of outrageous injustice in the modern world. In the early speeches, for example, it's quite obvious that as the material was released by the State Department, we got much more information on what happened at Hiroshima and what happened at Dresden. For example, what happened at Dresden, Germany, after we were certain that the Allied powers were going to surrender. Does anyone recall? It was carried on as a military policy by our government at that time.
Firebombings
of Dresden. What kind of a city was it? Industrial? No. Who were there?
Civilians.
What kind of civilians, primarily? The old and the very young. They were defenseless. It was that way. But that, as a kind of reprisal, was firebombed by Allied bombers toward the end of the war. We never heard about this as citizens. It wasn't released from the archives until about 10 years later, when we began to hear something about, you know, in other words, the Watergate kind of experience has its history all the way through our culture. Things like this outraged McLeish. What about Hiroshima? As you may or may not know,
it
was all right. Here's another tremendous, and not only that, we do know that letters were sent by concerned scientists who wished, and I mentioned this in another context once before, who had urged that the government at least have the courtesy to let the Japanese military leaders know what would happen if they would drop an atomic bomb. That letter was, we don't know, we think it was ignored by the State Department. And so, well, maybe it had to be. You know, who wants to judge on our own past history on this? Nevertheless, for a McLeish, this was again a terrible outrage on the question of whether there are any powers in the universe that will stop us from terrible acts of cruelty against other human beings in the name of human justice. And so, if God is God, he can't be good, because a good God would, in McLeish's term, not allow this. He may exist. He may be the distant voice, but obviously, in McLeish's terms, he doesn't care. If he cared, this would not happen to these people. Now, back to our old question. Is there anything worse than death? And J.B. says to Nichols, I've prayed for it, asked for it. When a man has gone through what McLeish has J.B. go through, there can't be anything worse than what? A life which is lived under conditions of meaningless suffering. To be reduced to that is the worst thing that can happen to man. Particularly if, now here's where the presumptions come in, we assume that if God exists as a distant voice whom we hear, but he obviously does not care. So it's not accidental, but how does this play in? Even though it's often performed in churches. And the original line is even much more sure. McLeish means this when he's saying this. They when Sarah comes back with her little sprig of forsythia, and the green, we know, turns into a flower, and this is the sign of human love, Sarah says, it's all the light now. Sarah comes forward into the dim room, JB behind her. She lifts a fallen chair, sets it straight. Blow on the call of the heart. The candles in churches are out. Out! You don't go to the church for the kind of comfort and love that McLeish sees the contemporary world in need of. The lights have gone out in the sky. Blow on the call of the heart, and we'll see by and by. We'll see where we are. The wit won't burn and the wet soul smolders. Blow on the coal of the heart and we'll know. We'll know. And that's, well, that's really not the end of the play. The actual acting text differs from the text we have in our books. If you saw the book on, and the trouble is I don't have my own text here, so I can't tell you what the actual ending was. I can tell you that what McLeish did was he made it more strong on the need for human love. And so Sarah and JB exchange a little bit stronger kind of statement, suggesting that even if there are only distant stars, there is this little possibility that we can create in a world emptied of transcendent meaning, we can blow on the coals of the heart and have human love. Well, I want to just stop there. Today, we're working 2 days on JB. I'm sorry for taking so much time and rehearsing the story, but I feel it's important for us to know exactly the direction of this play so that we can see how really, I'm not going to say it's unchristian. I think it's one of the finest plays around. I think it should be acted in Christian churches, and our Christian members should act in it, but they should know that what they are acting in has very little relationship either to New Testament Christianity, to the kind of contemporary concerns in literature about the transcendent experience of God in literature, nor does it have a great deal of relationship to the Book of Job. And why this is the case, I'd like to expand on tomorrow.